Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hey, everybody. Aiden here. And today we have a real special treat for you. About a year ago, in the fall of 2023, John got together with a live audience and recorded the 40th anniversary edition of Tracking Our Roots in Nature, which is his seminal audio series that really goes over how to deeply connect with nature, with yourself, with others, and provides the roadmap. And this 40th anniversary edition is the biggest picture that he has provided. It's really, you know, now that he's moved into his 60s, he's really providing the perspective of an elder, of a bigger picture. And he also has the perspective now of 40 years of seeing this movement grow all over the world and having witnessed with his own eyes. And, you know, I'm lucky enough here now in my early 40s to have done the same, where we have met children who have grown up with this work and grown into adulthood and started organizations of their own and started to spread their own visions out into the world for really connecting people to nature and building community around that. And so today we wanted to share with you two excerpts from that product, from Tracking Our Roots in Nature. Let me tell you a little bit about the first story, which is John telling the story of what happens when we start to really ask deep questions and let go and throw those questions out into the universe. And as Tom Brown put it, what happens when the 99th coincidence becomes the 100th coincidence? Do you still call it a coincidence? Enjoy.
There's this thing called magical thinking, right? Someone might accuse you of magical thinking as if it's a negative thing. But one of the gifts of tracking is that it actually puts us in touch with a sense of magic, a true sense of magic. Tracking teaches us some amazing things about synchronicity. I had an experience when I was 15 where I guess I probably had at this point maybe 30 or 40 experiences that Tom was mentoring me during that time. And he said to me, well, what do you think of that? And I said, God, it's a crazy coincidence. He says, a coincidence? And I said, yeah. He says, John, how many times have you called these things a coincidence? When the 99th coincidence turns 100, will you still be calling it a coincidence? And then he says, better yet, John, get yourself a journal and call it your coincidence journal, quote unquote, and mark them down and number them. And when you get to 100, I want you to bring that journal to me and have a conversation with me. And that was right just before he opened the tracker school. So it took me about 2 years to get to 100, but I got there. And it was a pretty amazing experience. The first coincidence that he was talking about in my journal, because up to that point, I hadn't been counting coincidences. I was, you know, starting to pay attention to tracks, and I've been maybe paying attention to them more thoroughly for about two and a half years. And I kept seeing this strange scratch mark. It was like two dull claws kind of going in a weird angle every 22 inches. And I could not figure out for the life of me what this thing was. Like, what is this? And the soil was kind of hard pan. You know, it was like summer. It had rained and then it baked in the sun. And so just the scratches were showing up and I wasn't able to see more. And I told Tom about it. I said, do you know what animal like leaves a scratch mark like this every 22 inches? He's like, I don't know. He said, have you looked in the tracking guide? I said, I went through the tracking guide like, you know, 20 times, Tom, I cannot figure out what this is. He says, okay. He says, well, sounds like you've exhausted all possibilities, you know, trying to figure it out physically. I'm like, yeah. He said, well, have you thought about asking the track? I said, why would I ask the track? Is it going to answer me? You know, in my wise guy jersey teenager mind. He's like, have you tried it? I'm like, no. He says, well, why don't you try? And I'm like, You mean literally go out there and talk to two scratch marks on the ground and ask what it is? He says, yeah. He says, but as soon as you do, let go. Just let go. Forget that you even care about the answer. Just have no attachment. Just let it go. And then just when you're out there and you're wandering around, if you suddenly feel called to go this way or pulled to go that way while you're walking, and you might think you're going this way, but you suddenly feel like you want to go that way instead, well, then go ahead and listen and see what happens. I'm like, okay. So I awkwardly went out to my sit area. I found the two scratch marks, and I kind of looked around to make sure no one was looking or listening. And I said, scratch marks, what are you? I really need to know, you know, because the one thing he was really emphasizing was I need to know the answer. It's got to come from my core. You know, I got to, what is this? I'm so frustrated. I got to know. But it's coming from a deep place within. It's not coming from my head. And I asked the question, you know, awkwardly, but from that core place, what are you? And I let it go. A couple days later, I had these creatures living in my basement that needed to eat tadpoles. And they were small garter snakes. And I know, sorry. And I knew just where to get the tadpoles. So I left my mother's backyard and I start cutting through the bushes and I'm going across the neighbor's backyard. And I have to cut through another set of bushes to get to the Shramko's house where they have a pond there. And I've been given permission to catch as many frogs and tadpoles as I want. And so as I'm wandering towards the Shramko's pond, I suddenly feel this pull for no reason. I know I'm going to the Shramko's pond. I got a bucket in my hand, for God's sake, right? I feel pulled to the right. So I'm like, okay, I hear Tom's words in my head. If I suddenly feel pulled off course, then just listen. So I walk down the hill to the right, and it starts to go down towards the creek. And as it gets closer to the creek, I'm walking on this little hardpan trail, and I see two scratch marks every 22 inches. I'm like, huh. And as it gets closer to the creek, the soil gets softer, and all of a sudden it's walking in the wet sand along the creek. And what do I see? But a raccoon, very clear, three raccoon tracks are very clear. The fourth one has been smushed by one of those leg hold traps, and the foot was broken and disfigured, and the two claws were on one foot with scratching off to one side. And that became coincidence number one in my journal. So when it turned 100, it was because I had found a raccoon turd near a dumpster at Rutgers University, Cook College, in the parking lot. I looked at this raccoon turd. I know this is maybe gross to some of you, but, you know, you take a stick and you kind of pick it apart to see what the raccoon's been eating. And I prided myself in that time that I knew every seed that was in a raccoon turd where I grew up from around my sit spot. I knew every seed. I knew rose hips. I knew the, you know, the honeysuckle berries, on and on. So I'm recognizing many of the seeds and skins of fruits that are in this turd. But then I hit this one big one. It's, you know, it's about the size of, I don't even know how to say that. It's big around as my thumb knuckle, really. Almost that big and flat. And kind of like the shape of a watermelon seed, but much bigger, with wood grain on it. And so I brought it back to the dorm. I had no idea what it was. I cleaned it really good. And then I, you know, after cleaning it with soap and water, and then I just sort of buffed it with my thumbs and my fingers and shined it all up. And it was actually really beautiful. It was like you could make jewelry out of this thing, but you wouldn't want to make jewelry out of a raccoon turd. That would be weird. But I kept it in my pocket and I showed it to my dendrology professor. He didn't know what it was. I showed it to the TAs at dendrology. They didn't know what it was. I was looking it up. In those days, you know, there was no internet, so you couldn't just kind of Google search, you know, big brown seeds, you know, New Brunswick, New Jersey, whatever. But so that wasn't an option. And what I did was I eventually realized that I wasn't solving this mystery after weeks. And I told, the turd, please tell me where this seed comes from. And I let it go. And by then, I was comfortable that this actually worked. When you have a really good question that comes from your core, and you've tried everything physically, you've tried to work it out with your mind, you've looked it up, you've done your diligence, and you've tried and tried, and you still can't solve it, ask the turd and let it go. So a couple mornings later, and I was a freshman in college, and I was very awkward, very shy. And there's a knock on the door, and it's my friends who live in the dorm who are all going to the cafeteria for breakfast. Do you want to come, John? And, you know, I'm stoked. These guys, the cool guys, asked me to go to the cafeteria. I have to go. But something said, no, don't go. My body, like, felt resistant. It was really interesting. And I'm like, no, I don't think so. And they're like, why? You know, our company isn't good enough, man. You know, like this kind of stuff. I said, no. I don't know why. I just don't feel like going right now. And they're like, okay, well, if you change your mind, that's where we'll be. So they left. About 5 minutes later, there's a knock on my door. And I open the door, and there's this girl, Jennifer, standing in the doorway, and there's someone I have this mad crush on, but I'm terrified of. She's standing in the door, and I'm like, oh, hi, Jennifer. She says, hey, John, I'm going out to the research forest, and I'm going to pick persimmons. Do you want to come? And I'm like, yeah, heck yeah. You know, so I went with her. We went for this walk, and we have to cross over, got Highway 1 right there that goes by the campus is, I swear, I'm remembering this correctly, 5 lanes of traffic in both directions with a concrete divider, okay? And there's an overpass that we're going across, but it's got cars going on it, you know? We get across the overpass. We go through that little loop-de-loop that they call exits or jug handles in New Jersey. We kind of cut across that. We go under the chain link fence, and we go into the research forest. We go to this persimmon tree, and we knock down some persimmons, and she hands one to me. She says, have you ever had one of these before? I said, no. She said, they're really astringent, like a green banana. So be ready for that. But they're also sweet. So I bite into it and I hit this hard seed and I spit it into my hand and it's the seed. And I can't believe it because all of a sudden, all these questions come into my mind. How did that raccoon cross 10 lanes of crazy tractor trailer traffic? Did it really go in rider's lane across that overpass? I don't think so. How's it getting there without dying? I asked her, are there more persimmon trees like this around? She said, no, this was planted by Dr. Somebody here so many years ago. It's native to another part of New Jersey, but it's not native here. It's the only one. So now I'm convinced I got to figure out how the raccoon is crossing the road. But think about what that's doing. My curiosity, my passion to know, my relationship building with the raccoon, even when I get an answer from a sacred question, as Tom would call it, there's more questions right behind it, right? Because tracking, it may be what we're born to do, but we never master it. Tracking is so much bigger than all of us because, as Jim Corbett, the famous tracker from India, said, because the book of nature has no beginning as it has no end. No matter how much we've learned up until this point in our lives, we will never learn everything there is to know. But when you understand the art of asking the good question, the art of the sacred question, the art of trusting all your senses and going into that silent place that bird language gets us to, learning to trust your gut, your curiosity, your passion to know, trusting your body radar to lead you to the right place at the right time, the world comes alive with magic. But this is not magical thinking because there's no thinking involved.
If you're interested, we have a free event coming up on December 10th called The Ultimate Wilderness Skill, and we're going to be exploring awareness and how awareness can empower our skills, deepen our relationships, and help us pass forward a legacy of connection to future generations. And if you're interested in joining us, you can find the link to sign up in the show notes. And whether or not you can attend live, you can go ahead and sign up for that link and you'll get an access to the recording afterwards so you can listen on your own time. This next piece is a story John tells from Petal 6 of Tracking Our Roots in Nature, which is the time of twilight. And it's a time when we start to think about our legacy and how we can pass things forward to the next generation. And this story here is a story about the hope that can come from getting a chance to really take care of our place. I hope you enjoy.
There's a lot of people in their 20s, 30s around here who experienced this catastrophic wildfire of 2020 called the CZU Lightning Complex Fire. We hadn't moved into this house yet. We had just signed the lease for it the day the fire started. And we didn't know that we weren't going to be able to move in until November 1st because this whole landscape burned and the fire burned within 10 feet of the corner of our house. And a neighbor happened to come and put it out, thankfully. Otherwise, this house wouldn't have been here for us. But, you know, after that fire passed through, it left devastation in terms of these, you know, 100, 200-year-old oaks and madrone trees that are just left standing as skeletons, you know. For you can stand on the ridge and look over 15,000 acres and see half of the trees have been killed. You know, the redwoods somehow are miraculously coming back from their trunks, but not all of them. And the trees were weakened and they were scarred and they were killed in great numbers. Then we had a really, really rainy winter last winter, and we had this bomb cyclone hit. So the ground got really wet and all these trees fell on our neighbor's property to the north, and they have 10 acres, and about 150 trees fell down on their property. So just imagine that. You know, these trees are 200 feet tall, some of them. Okay. So we're not talking about, you know, little trees. We're talking about trunks that are massive, like 6-8 feet in diameter. And these trees that when you walk on them, you feel, you know, you're walking on a bridge through the forest for a really long way. And these trees, you know, the insurance that came to this family after the fires was enough to take care of a few things. But the extreme cost of actually doing something about that many trees is absolutely prohibitive. And this is happening all over the world right now. Massive wildflower fires that are just completely burning out of control and much more intense than they ever have been. And communities trying to recover from these fires, looking around and saying, how in the heck are we going to do anything about this damage? It's massive. There isn't enough money in the government to pay for the restoration of the Santa Cruz Mountains, right? And I introduced my friend Gabe to our neighbors to the north, and he has this commercial mill, and he has the spirit of Petal Six so deep within him. We call him the forest gnome. And, you know, he had texted us one evening and said, hey, I'm working on a burn pile. You know, basically you take all the slash from those trees and make a big pile, and you sit by it all night long and burn it until morning. He says, I'm working on a burn pile. Come up and visit me. So Sarah and I walked up there and we saw the fire and we come walking up in the night. We don't see Gabe anywhere. You know, the fire's burning, you know, and there's all these giant Doug fir logs that are cut into 10-foot lengths laying on their side in stacks. And we're like, well, the fire's here, but I don't see Gabe. And then all of a sudden we hear a voice and he sits up. He was laying down on those logs. And then he came over and he sat by us and he said, you know, I had a vision sitting here by this fire. I had a vision of what we could do. There's all these young people I know that have lost hope. They're feeling really like hopeless about climate change. They're feeling paralyzed by the enormity of what these fires brought, and that there's nothing that anyone can do. Their families can't afford to fix the land, and nobody wants to take the time to restore the native forests, and they're feeling really hopeless about the future. And he said, but what we could do, you know, you and John, you and Sarah, you could teach them tracking and bird language and art of mentoring, and we'll teach them permaculture, and I'll teach them forestry skills. I'll teach them how to, you know, cut the logs and mill the logs and then plane the logs and put them to dimensional size. My friend is a lumber grader, so he'll come and inspect and stamp the wood so we could sell it to Bonnie Doon people who want to rebuild their homes. And the neighbors over here need to rebuild some cabins, and then we can take the native plants and we can restore them, and we'll teach them, you know, how to restore a native forest, and we'll bring in the indigenous people locally to teach them about using fire to tend the land. And he inspired the heck out of both of us. He got like two or three young people that he started to work with on this property. And we started to just test some of these ideas with them. You know, we didn't start a vocational school. We just started to test it with some of the people that were working for him. And they had a total turnaround. You know, this one guy, he just gets up early in the morning just to come and work on the project because it gives him so much hope, right? So there's something about learning to tend not just a tree or a spring, but a landscape. And to come together as community to do it with a vision, a purpose greater than ourselves, as Tom Brown always says, you know, the greatest results come when we have a purpose greater than ourselves. Our sense of vision, our sense of purpose arises from that. And so Gabe has already attracted some grants, and he's gotten some really cool equipment that has been donated to the project that will help this to go. And, you know, let's just put our blessings behind projects like this all over the world, because it's going to take a new way of thinking, you know, going into the future, right? When we take a moment and we close our eyes and we send our minds seven generations into the future, and we talk to the children around that fire, seven generations, and we ask them, what do they need? What do they want? They'll make it really clear what we have to do in our lifetime. And that purpose greater than self will fill us with spirit. It'll fill us with vision, and it'll give us something that brings us together in unity.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's sample of Tracking Our Roots in Nature. And if you're interested in learning more, again, we have a free event on December 10th. And you can just follow the link in the show notes of today's podcast episode. And whether or not you can attend live, if you join that link, you'll get a recording, and that'll give you more information. And then you can also stay tuned to see when Tracking Our Roots in Nature goes on sale next week. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.